Rewind, your year in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
I believe united we stand, and we have common ground to find, and we're going to find it. We're not even
I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And this is the 2019 year in review version of Rewind. Pretty amazing year, J.R.
That was quiet.
It was quiet. All right, we're going to count down the top 10, but first let's start with some honorable mentions, give a few shout outs to those. Honorable mention number one, Ray Cross retires as UW System President, gone 5 years. Any thoughts on that?
Not a surprise that he retired because he's kind of at that age.
Yes.
We've been on the retirement watch with Ray for a while now. The question is, what's the system going to look for, the Board of Regents going to look for in the next president? Because remember, the Board of Regents is still mainly made up of Walker appointees. So you have this kind of odd juxtaposition of a board mostly appointed by the Republican governor, predecessor, versus Governor Evers now in office and what he's looking for in a president. So interesting how that plays out.
And I want to correct myself. I said he'd been gone 5 years. He's been service as president for 5 years. Okay, honorable mention number two. J.R., the fight over closing the two juvenile prisons and replacing them with regional facilities means there's very little substantive progress because of cost concerns, and those two juvenile prisons stay open. I've got that as an honorable mention.
Yeah, what we're watching for are the regional facilities. The costs that counties put forward came in higher than what was expected originally. I mean, I think we knew back in 2018 when this package was pushed through that the $80 million, I think, total for new state facilities for the worst of the worst offenders and then regional facilities was not enough money.
I got the feeling they kind of pulled those numbers out of the air.
Yeah, and we kind of knew they'd come back and ask for more, but I don't think they had an idea like just how much more it was going to cost. The challenges of trying to locate these facilities, who was going to run them. It's been more work than I think they anticipated, and closing Lincoln Hills is going to be more of a challenge to meet the deadline.
Huge issue in 2020. Mm-hmm. Honorable mention number three, the emerging key role, the outspoken role that Republican Senator Ron Johnson is going to play, has played, and is playing in impeachment. Surprise you?
It's interesting. He just happened to kind of be there for a lot of like these things. Just was the guy in the room. Now, there's reasons why. I mean, his chairmanship with
of a key
in the Senate. He's part of the Ukraine caucus, they call it. All these kinds of things. He's also kind of a central role in pushing the idea, raising questions about whether Ukraine played a role in the 2016 election.
Yeah.
It's been dismissed as a conspiracy theory by many in Washington, D.C., but there is a group of Republicans who keep pushing this because the president is pushing this idea that it was Ukraine that it meddled, not Russia. Mm. He keeps pushing that idea. Also, his committee has been hearing testimony from the FBI about this report on the kind of the genesis of the whole thing with President Trump and really trying to be a vocal supporter of President Trump and this whole thing.
And Senator Johnson said it didn't have to, the whole thing didn't have to be exposed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay, let's count down the top 10. We don't have a regular in-studio drummer, but we have a Whiz Kitty, and so it's time for Whiz Kitty to count us down to number 10. The number 10, the crisis in Dairyland. JR, this is something that I list as number 10, and you and I agreed, because it's largely driven by national and international, but I don't want to minimize the pain of our dairy farmers. You're going to hear Representative Taylor say, we lost 551 dairy farms in 2019, but we're losing almost two a day. So I don't want to minimize this, but it's so influenced by state and international factors.
Two things about this politically. One, Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue came into Wisconsin for World Dairy Expo and paraphrasing said basically talk about the economies of scale and farming. Those comments were interpreted as go big or go home. Now, there are some who try to push back that he really said that, but that's how it was reported. There's some danger there for the Trump administration in terms of like alienating the farm community about that. So there's that. And two, we don't have fewer cows in Wisconsin. We're getting more consolidation. And why I bring that up is the whole discussion about siting rules for large farm operations. We're having this conflict of people moving out to, we call them the exurbs now, and getting up next to these big factory farms, some call them, and having a conflict. The siting rules played a role in Brad Pfaff being rejected as Ag Secretary.
Which we'll get to in a little bit.
So there's a lot going on with the farm community. It is not the same dairy community that my grandfather farmed in southeastern Wisconsin his whole life, or most of it. His father before him farmed. His father before him farmed. It's not the same kind of small dairy farm economy for the ag community.
Yeah, it is. And my grandfather was a dairy farmer in northern Ohio. Okay, that's number 10. Let's listen to a little bit of the video capturing the issue of crisis in America's dairyland.
I wish we were gathered under better circumstances in terms of where we are currently at as a dairy industry. Obviously, dairy prices are at historic lows. They have reached a peak in 2014, and unfortunately, dairy has been break-even at best since then. So farmers are used to going through ebbs and flows, peaks and valleys, but not used to losing money for 5 years in a row.
I tell my friends in town, you don't know what it's like. We have no savings. We have no benefits. Why am I encouraging this? You're to continue on the family farm. And I've had so many people that have told me, too, we'll just sell the farm and get a job. Well, like, who's going to buy it? Who's going to buy this farm that's losing money?
This is the front page story in the Wisconsin State Journal, a warning for small farms. When I look at these numbers, it's hard to believe. We lost 551 dairy farms so far in 2019. We lost 638 in 2018, and we lost 465 in 2017. I represent an urban, obviously my district's very urban, but even my constituents are writing to me saying they are alarmed what's happening to our small dairy farmers.
JR, number 9 is Governor Evers said earlier in the year, I would like the legislature to pass 2 gun laws, universal background checks and red flags. He said, I'm thinking about a special session. He then called a special session. Republican leaders said, we're not even going to debate it. We're not going to hold public hearings on those 2 bills. They just essentially ignored it. That's number 9 because I'll go first. It is not a surprise that the Republicans went home on the call. No. What's your take?
The political dynamic of this has been, and we've talked about this before, yes, those bills in the Marquette poll are 80% issues with voters in Wisconsin, but Republicans told me repeatedly that they don't feel pressure back home about these. Yes, they're popular, but they're not driving people to the polls. 2, when you get to single-issue voters on guns, a lot of Republicans have mostly pro-Second Amendment voters, not ones supporting these bills, who are driven by these issues. Therefore, they're more kind of sensitive to the views of those who are pro-Second Amendment on these things. They're just not feeling any pressure. And the only kind of risk that I've heard about for Republicans is if something happened, again, God forbid, that could have been prevented by these 2 laws, then they would feel some pressure. But so far, we're not seeing that. You say, that wouldn't have happened in Wisconsin if those bills had been in place.
And just a P.S., this is one of the issues that Governor Evers says, I will campaign against Republicans who don't support these 2 gun safety, public safety issues. He's just avowed that. But anyway, so number 9, the Republicans ignored the Evers call for gun safety laws, and let's take a listen to some of the debate on that issue.
Since taking office in January, I called on the legislature to take action and pass common sense gun safety reform. Unfortunately, the Republicans did not act. So today, as promised, I'm calling on the legislature to meet for a special session on gun safety reform.
These are not partisan issues. They are common sense public safety issues. It seems like the only place we can't find majority support for this legislation is in the Wisconsin state legislature.
What do you think about special session?
Positive. 80% of the people in the state of Wisconsin are supporting these bills, and there's no reason why the legislature shouldn't go along.
They keep citing this 80% number, right, that's the reason he's doing it. Well, there's a new poll out today that shows 65% of people do not support Medicare for All, right? And I think it's 60%+ support detaining people who are here illegally at the border. But I don't expect all of them to just flip what they believe in simply because a poll disagrees with what they personally ran on. So to believe that somehow those of us who strongly support the Second Amendment and know that a red flag law would allow people to have a firearm taken away before they've done anything wrong with very little due process, that is something most of us just do not support. So that's why the bill's not going to come up.
The hour of 2 p.m. on November 7th, having arrived, the Assembly is in special session. Gentlemen from the 5th, Mr. Speaker, I move the Assembly stand adjourned pursuant to SJR 1.
It's a non-debatable motion. All in favor will say aye. Those opposed, no. The ayes have it. The Assembly is adjourned pursuant to SJR 1.
Number 8, as we discussed in our last rewind, the unexpected resignation of our Adjutant General, Donald Dunbar, longest-serving general in command of Air and Air Force in the country, had been there in that job since 2007, served Governors Doyle and then Walker and now Mr. Evers. So that's number 8, because that's a significant change in who is supervising our guard and emergency management, correct?
Oh, along with that, just the depth of the problem. Some great reporting that uncovered that the guard essentially in this final report had created its own process for investigating complaints of sexual harassment and assault. It went against Department of Defense policy. It blew people's minds when I talked to them that they would go to this length to do something like this. I mean, this is not how you're supposed to do things.
Right.
I mean, I guess one theory I heard was that Dunbar believed such in states' rights and that, you know, that this was okay for us to do this, that he ignored the DOD policy, but that's not the way it's supposed to be done. It kind of blew people's minds, again, that they would do something like this. And quite frankly, they botched the investigations. It was a real problem.
Yeah, it was. And are you hearing that the interim general is a candidate for the job permanently? Have you heard?
I think we expect
the
governor.
I think the governor expected
to announce somebody new sometime early next year, but I'm not sure. I think the interim is like for retirement sometime before. I can't remember when exactly, so don't hold me to that, but I think we're expecting an announcement sometime early next year.
Okay, now let's call on Little Drummer WizKitty to take us to number 7. The number 7, Milwaukee, chosen to host the next July 13th through 16th Democratic National Convention. Why is this number 7?
Symbolism and math. Symbolism, the blue wall of Wisconsin, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania crumbled in 2016 for Democrats. Trump won all three. Democrats realized that they made a mistake, or Hillary Clinton made a mistake, when she didn't come to Wisconsin and have the general election. She thought it was in the bag. I mean, that was a perception, right? Go back to 2016.
She never came after the primary, did she?
Go back to 2016. It was about how Clinton was going to expand the map and win these kind of Republican-leaning states and have a blowout. And she neglected these states that you have to have if you're a Democrat to win. They came to Wisconsin, or coming to Wisconsin, I should say, in part sent a message of, we're not going to neglect these states again. We know, Democrats are saying, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania are key. Mathematically, if you're Donald Trump, your best way to win re-election is to hold what you had before. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
Just focus on those three states again. Pennsylvania and Michigan are more Democratic and more diverse than Wisconsin is. They both went harder toward Democrats in 2018 in kind of a wave year. So the idea is that for Trump, if you're not winning Wisconsin, you're not winning Michigan and or Pennsylvania. So he needs Wisconsin. That's the math piece. Democrats know if they pick off Wisconsin, they make the Trump map very hard. He then has to go, okay, he's going to go to Minnesota, hasn't gone Republican since 1972. New Mexico lost by 8 points in 2016. Colorado lost by 5. So it's a difficult math problem for Trump if he loses, again, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin,
which he won by less than 23,000 votes, which makes probably one of the biggest stories in 2020, this debate, this controversy over the 234,000 movers, which we're not going to get into because it'll be a 2020 huge
story.
And
don't forget the convention coming here. Democrats are talking about this. It's not just about a convention, but about building infrastructure to fix the problem in 2016. Republicans, meanwhile, want to see quote-unquote crazy on display in Milwaukee during the convention. They want to see the fringes of the Democratic Party on full display to send a message to voters in outstate Wisconsin and rural Michigan and rural Pennsylvania of this is what you got coming for you up here to Donald Trump.
Okay. Time to hear some video clips about Milwaukee, why Milwaukee was chosen over Miami and Houston for the Democratic National Convention.
Milwaukee went up against two of the biggest cities in the country. We raised double the amount of money that Houston and Miami was able to raise. That really showed everyone that when we want something and when we, you know, dare to dream big for an event and when we put our, you know, our collective muscle and minds together in effort to bring something this enormous to our state, We can do it, and we can go up against anyone.
Milwaukee is, and the state of Wisconsin and really this part of the country is an incredibly inspired choice for this convention. I think it's an important place for Democrats to be as we take the historic step of nominating our candidate for president. I think it's important to be in a place that really aligns with Democratic values. This is really an opportunity for us to, as a party, to nominate our candidate for president and vice president.
Number six, the state Senate taking maybe what would have, it was a historical vote, maybe unprecedented, fired the state ag secretary Brad Pfaff, the choice of Governor Tony Evers. This is number six because it was unprecedented. You and I know, going back to the first governors, generally, the whoever a governors choose as to their cabinet secretaries have been allowed to run the agencies and report to the governor. That's why. And also, you have this uncertainty over at least four cabinet secretaries, tourism, transportation, and professional services, and which other one?
Tourism, health and human health services.
Health services. Uncertainty about whether they'll be confirmed ever. Mm-hmm. So number six, the Senate firing of Brad Pfaff. Please.
I've used two phrases more in my reporting this year and doing stuff like this than I ever have. One, I've never seen this before.
Right.
And two, they have to write the phrase rare if not unprecedented. And the reason why I have to use that phrase so much is because we only have so many records about this stuff.
Records don't exist.
Reference Bureau said going back to 1987, they have not seen this before.
Right.
But nobody kept these records before that. So we don't know for sure if a cabinet secretary has ever been rejected. There's a number of layers of that story about Brad. One, there was this fallout over his response to the legislature about farmer mental health. There's this program to provide grants to vouchers to farmers having a mental health crisis to go get treatment.
Right.
They were working, Republicans were working on this part of a speaker's task force on suicide prevention. Brad didn't turn information over to the chair of that committee. He then prodded joint finance in very harsh terms to get something done about this. That was a problem. And it was interesting because for a lot of the secretaries I've heard questions about, the idea was, okay, they're just going to sit. They're not going to bring them to the floor. They're just going to let them sit. They can serve without confirmation, get paid, have all the same powers. We'll just let them sit. Something changed with Brad. And the story I got back, there were a number of layers of the story. One was his treatment of lawmakers. Another, the citing rules about large farms with animals, that there was a lot of unhappiness
about that
in the ag community. Also, there's a layer about caucus politics in the state Senate with the Republicans. Scott Fitzgerald running for Congress. There are all kinds of layers of that story, but at the end, Brad didn't make any friends when he hadn't been confirmed, and it came back to bite him.
Well, okay, but part of that, as we've alluded to in an earlier show, in February, four or five Republican senators voted to confirm him, only to have the caucus unified to fire him. It's just, it's number six, and it's a very justifiable number six. And here's some of the debate regarding the dismissal of Ag Secretary Brad Pfaff.
I was raised on a dairy farm in northern La Crosse County. I recognize and I understand the challenge that our farmers and our agriculture community currently face.
Agriculture's changed an awful lot in the last 13 years, and this rule has not been updated since that time. When it was put in place, family farmers were looking at expanding from 50 cows to potentially 300 or 500 cows. Mm-hmm. Now family farmers are looking, maybe they want to expand further. And with that, we have local units of government as well as local citizens are asking questions.
When it came to Brad Pfaff, I told the governor, I said, I don't think there's enough support there for him, and it's because of a number of missteps that have happened actually going back to February. And whether it's comments related to DATCAP, ATCP 51, comments about Republicans and farmer suicide, and I think as we stand here today, there's a number of members of the majority that just aren't comfortable with Brad Pfaff. And that's all it really takes for people to say, I don't support this nominee.
At the end of the day, when they decided to do a kind of a political assassination of Brad Pfaff, that kind of pushed me to a different place. I don't think they're bastards, but I think they did make a huge mistake in not doing what they did to Brad Pfaff.
Number five, GR, the clean water woes worsened statewide. Mm-hmm. The governor proclaimed this a year of clean water. But I'm going to, just today, you and I saw a press release from the DNR saying PFAS, PFA, that's this mm-hmm. dangerous chemical, have been found at the intersection of the Olbrich boat ramp and Lake Monona. So we have nitrates. We have concerns, obviously, in Kiwanis County. We'll hear about that in a minute. The water woes are growing, and the speaker told me in a year-end interview, yes, we have some recommendations that will be announced, but this is clearly a number five on our list.
Yeah, it cuts across party lines, cuts across geographical lines. It's in urban and rural areas. What's going to be interesting to watch is how it develops in 2020. Yeah. Because in 2018, we saw ads already in some legislative races about clean water, concerns in Kiwanis County about essentially manure yes. polluting groundwater.
It's a whole debate over CAFOs.
So now what happens in 2020? How do they address this out of the elections in 2020? Because if it's not addressed, it'll be an issue again for some lawmakers and their campaigns.
And will it get worse? And how much will it cost to remediate some of these issues?
So it's don't forget with the lead laterals, which are part of the problem in Milwaukee.
Thank you.
That the Republican-controlled legislature did not want to do what Evers want to do in terms of paying for that. So that's something to watch.
Yeah, it really is. And let's listen to some of the video about the debate over clean water, including a woman who lives in Kiwanis talking about the number of polluted wells.
Thousands of wells and service lines deliver undrinkable or contaminated water to folks across the state. Now, obviously, this is a serious public health issue. I am proud to say that my cabinet has embraced my directive to move rapidly and proactively to implement clean water initiatives around the state.
Kiwanis County has been known for groundwater contamination. We have about 31% of our wells testing unsafe for nitrogen and bacteria. And if you go into our karst region, which is our shallow soils, you're upwards to 40, 42, 43%. All five of our major rivers in Kiwanis County as of 2018 were all impaired on the EPA's list for phosphorus.
There are still people in the state of Wisconsin that turn their taps on and don't have surety that clean drinking water will come out the other end. And so today begins that conversations and about PFAS. And what else is coming down the pipe? Certainly as it relates to in our regulatory model, we'll be dealing with nitrates in waters. We'll also be dealing with pathogens and those types of things going forward. But today, that focus is with this group of chemicals that make up 3,000 to 4,000 chemicals that, quite frankly, put us in harm's way.
Number four, U.S. Representative James Sensenbrenner was elected in the 5th District, and let me get this right, 1978. So when he, number one, he chose to not seek re-election. He will have been there 40-plus years. So that's a part of number four. Second number four is, I was surprised, we were surprised, a surprise resignation, Republican U.S. House member Sean Duffy, District number 7. Why is that number four?
One thing I think when you're a political reporter, you pride yourself on not being surprised by things, at least being of heard rumblings or indication something might be going on. This one, I think, caught a lot of people off guard in different ways. With Duffy, the talk had been about whether he's going to run statewide in 2022. There wasn't really an indication he was looking at leaving, but his ninth child was born this year. When he announced he was going to step down, he said that that child had some health issues and he needed to be home with the family to kind of take care of that. Fast forward, he's now a contributor on CNN. Mm-hmm. He's also lobbying.
K Street lobbyist.
So that might be the end of Sean Duffy's career. I mean, it's not that you can't come back from lobbying to run for office again, but it's not a real good jumping point to get back into politics to be a lobbyist and go run for office when people hate the quote-unquote swamp. So this guy who may have been a candidate for governor or U.S. Senate 22 is now looked at as maybe not running in the future period. With Sensenbrenner, the conversation for years has been like, this guy's going to stay there as long as he's walking. He's an upright. He's going to be a congressman. It's his identity. But what I heard was that Sensenbrenner is so well known for his constituent outreach, for going to like town hall meetings.
Yes.
He runs them and with an iron fist sometimes. He's not afraid to mix it up with people.
He doesn't suffer fools.
No. But, you know, he's not getting around as well as he used to. It just happens when you get older.
Right.
And if you can't be the Jim Sensenbrenner that you've been for all these years, how do you continue to do that that role.
Right.
I get the impression it played a role in deciding to step down.
Also, his wife has had a critical illness. That's mm-hmm. a big deal. But let's talk about Sensenbrenner, because he mentored Ryan. He mentored Gallagher. He mentored Duffy. And every 10 years, he was Mr. Reapportionment. I mean, I never will forget when he told me, yeah, we had to give Democrat Ron Kind a few more Democrats to protect Sean. So this guy was just legendary in terms of reapportionment, plus former chairman of the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, and played a pretty active role in the last couple days in the debate over impeachment.
Anna Bashaw, you bring up the reapportionment piece of it. He told me that he thought there was a better chance of protecting his district, kind of using his words, if there was a freshman in the seat than a guy who's getting ready to retire, so that they would respect more that person's wishes. And what I get at by that is that if somehow it happens that lawmakers draw the lines and Governor Evers signs the map, there will be negotiations amongst the parties involved.
Right.
My bet right now is the courts can draw those lines, not the members of Congress, the governor, legislators.
I'm not going to bet, man, because that's the way it's going to play out.
But that said, in the past, when they have been able to work out a deal, it has been like the deans of the two delegations get together, or the partisan members of the delegation together, and kind of talk about, okay, what do you want?
And just a footnote. You quoted the new Democratic Party chairman, Ben Wickler, saying, conceding it's going to be tough mm-hmm. for Dems to win both in the 5th, Sensenbrenner's seat, and Duffy's, which will be the subject of a special election in May.
Dems' best hope in either of those two seats is a special election in May, because the idea of a low turnout race in May means if you have the more motivated base, you have a chance to pull an upset a la Patty Schottner in the 10th Senate District in western Wisconsin.
Yes.
Just a tough seat, though. Both tough seats for Democrats. So no matter what happens in Maine, that special election, the bet is that come November of 2020, they'll be both will be in Republican hands.
Okay, little drummer kitty, take us to number three. number three, Brian Hagedorn versus Judge Neubauer, mm-hmm. both Court of Appeals judges serving on the same court. The early money said Judge Neubauer looked pretty good, and then it got all these different nuances with the attacks on his faith and everything. Mm-hmm. And the irony is that you have a conservative Justice Hagedorn now on the court who replaced a moderate liberal, former Chief Justice, Justice Shirley Abramson. So number three, clearly.
Yeah, I think I've said before, when I do like this show or stuff that I write, it's not my opinion, it's about what I hear from people.
Yeah.
And what I heard from people on both sides of the aisle all through the spring was that Neubauer was in command of that race and Hagedorn was a long shot. Even the week before the election, people who were working for or on the Hagedorn effort were telling me, JR, it's a narrow path. There's a path there that's narrow. I pride myself on keeping an open mind and listening to both sides and trying to figure out what's going on. But most people I talked to said, you know, he doesn't really have that good of a shot. Then, in the final week of that race, there seemed to be a conservative revolt against the Neubauer campaign and the messages that she was driving, the ads that outside groups were running about, you know, Hagedorn's faith, his views on homosexuality, that this there was a revolt against it and a surge in support for Hagedorn. Let's also be honest, the Neubauer campaign didn't really go out of its way to run a great campaign. It played defense. It basically played don't make a mistake.
That's right.
Type of campaign. It came back to bite her. She gave people reason not to like Hagedorn, but not why to vote for her, other than these general platitudes about, like, you know, a fair and unbiased court. That also bit her, because if you're a conservative, you saw Brian Hagedorn being attacked and you got inspired. If you were a liberal, did you get inspired by Neubauer's campaign? You know, I would say the results say not so much.
Yeah, I agree. And that's why this next video clip is very interesting, because it starts with a group, a spokesman for a group against Hagedorn, and then now Justice Hagedorn talking about how he won. Please.
Anti-LGBTQ sentiments have been a guiding force in all aspects of Brian Hagedorn's personal and professional record. From writing hateful and misinformed things on a blog, to founding a school that openly opposes the basic civil rights of the LGBTQ community.
Nobody has ever raised one issue related to my judicial record of a time that I have ever let my own personal views get into my cases, because I never have and I never will. I will apply the law as it's written to everyone. I've said that from the beginning. I've been faithful to that in everything that I've done as a judge. We began to see a campaign against me, the likes of which we've probably never seen against a Supreme Court candidate. And they began to attack me in all sorts of ways with unprecedented amounts of money that came from the outside. They began to attack me for all sorts of things, my character, my integrity, and they began to attack my faith. When I got punched, you were the ones who punched back. When I got knocked down, you grabbed the baton and you kept running with it. You did this. You saved the Supreme Court. You helped preserve the rule of law and the Constitution in the state of Wisconsin. And I was just happy to fight with you and alongside you. And again, I'm here to say thank you.
Number two, JR, passage of a state budget, in which case both sides declared victory. When Governor Evers signed it, and we'll hear that in a minute, he said, we found a way to provide more money for transportation, and K-12 is top priority, excuse me, as a former superintendent of public schools. But state legislatures and governors are supposed to agree on a state budget. Why is this number two?
Well, to me, every odd-numbered year, state budget is always number one or number two, because it sets so much of what's going to happen in the two-year period. It's a policy statement, a vision statement from the governors. It is a, can you get anything done with the legislature? And in this case, you had a governor who was brand new, who laid out this very liberal vision of medical marijuana, decriminalizing marijuana, expanding Medicaid, go on down the list, a checklist of things he ran on, and are quite frankly popular with the public, and Republicans stripped out all of them, almost all of them, from the budget, and said, no, we're not going to do that. Republicans feel like Evers signed, quote-unquote, their budget, right, and that was a win. Evers feels like that he pulled lawmakers along on a huge boost in spending for education. Remember, Scott Walker in the 17-19 budget put a big chunk of money in education, kind of protect his flank, right, because he knew it was going to be a difficult reelect and that was going to be an issue. Tony Evers got him to put more money on top of that boost just 2 years ago,
yeah,
into education, because that was a big priority for voters and part reason why he won. So he feels like he got some things, but like the big kind of checklist of policy provisions, redistricting reform, those kinds of things, they weren't in there.
Okay, but what does this say about our next budget fight? Are we again going to be fighting over Medicaid expansion, K-12, and
yes,
transportation?
Yes.
Because we have no
yes,
permanent transportation solution.
No.
Kind of a one-time fix, correct?
Usually governors do two different kinds of budgets. The first budget they do is a pain budget. Basically, it is, you know, how do I set myself up for the second budget, which is the re-election budget. So if you got to cut spending or raise taxes, you do it first one. So in the second one, you can handle all these goodies, right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that Evers is going to get much of a goodie budget in 2021 because this budget was such a difficult process. And now, you know, we'll see after 2020 if there's a different legislature, you know, in both houses. My guess is it's going to be Republican controlled. They haven't proven yet they can work together. And if Evers can't work with them or get them to compromise with them and vice versa, what do they get done?
Right.
It's basically a cost to continue budget, or Republicans say, hey, you were so difficult to work with last time, your budget's DOA, we're going to write our own budget this time and see where we go from there.
Right. So it's time to hear what Governor Evers said when he signed that budget. A very short clip, please.
Today, I am signing a much better version of the legislature's budget. We were finally able to move the needle in the same Republican-controlled legislature we've had for the past 8 years. Vetoing this budget in its entirety also would have meant passing up on the opportunity to provide investments in special education, the largest per-pupil school aid increase in a decade. I'm proud we're delivering on a budget proposal that has the lowest level of transportation bonding in 20 years. It has $460 million in new funding for our highways, local roads, and transit aids, $320 million, which will go directly to state highway rehabilitation. And we did this all while giving a bump to mass transit aids for the first time in a decade.
Okay, JR, now you and I have been doing this for a fair amount of time, and you're number one, which you talked me into, mm-hmm, and I saw the wisdom of it. Lame duck session, fallout, poisons, bipartisanship. So let's look at four talking points, and then we can elaborate on
okay,
that. Number one, After the election, Walker and the Republicans came in and enact these lame duck bills, mm-hmm. limiting the authority of the governor and attorney general. So bullet point number one, the Supreme Court then upheld the lame duck laws. Bullet point number two, however, Justice Department, DOJ, and the Joint Finance Committee are still fighting over how to resolve the legal settlements. Representative Nygren told me that as recently as yesterday. Number three, the Supreme Court agreed to review the powers of governors to whether Governor Evers, let me start over, illegally acted on three or four specific vetoes. Mm-hmm. Now, they're reviewing veto power that governors have been using for decades. Mm-hmm. So, and number four, Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald said our goal was to act as a goalie to stop bad Governor Evers' ideas, and Speaker Voss later said kind of amen to that. Okay, that's my setup. Why did you lobby so hard for this to be number one?
Everything that happened this past year in the Capitol, almost everything, has a thread of it from the lame duck session. So, Brad Pfaff, typically you have secretaries confirm the first few months of governor's term.
Yes.
Because of the challenges to the lame duck laws, that didn't happen right away. Also then, there was a window because of one of the decisions basically rescinded 82 appointments that Governor Walker made and were confirmed by the state Senate.
Thank you.
Evers basically didn't reappoint those people, pulled most of those appointments back. Now, he at one point reappointed, I think, most of them. But there are a couple of key people, like Ellen Novak over at the Public Service Commission, former DOA secretary, who didn't get a reappointment from Evers. That inflamed tensions with Republicans, which kept the door open on the cabinet secretaries, which then led to Brad Pfaff running into trouble in the summer when normally he'd have been confirmed months later. The number of bills that got done were okay. It wasn't anything impressive because they didn't work together. You had, for example, this standoff about whether Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate leader, Assembly Speaker Voss, should be meeting with Maggie Gow, Governor Evers' chief of staff. Because they met with Eric Shute, who was the chief of staff to Scott Walker the last 2 years in office. They said, no, we're going to meet with the governor and not the chief of staff. Evers' staff accused him of being sexist about that, even though Robin Voss has a female chief of staff. I mean, like, there's all these threads of the tension of what got done versus what didn't get done, the budget process, the cabinet, it all comes back to the extraordinary session in December, which set this in motion.
So the idea, the message sent by the lame duck, to use the Governor Evers' terms, connected the dots and all the animosity for the whole year. Yeah. You see any signs that that's going to change in 2020 as we look forward?
No, look in December, there was a package of homelessness initiatives, okay? They were put into
price
a package.
Price tag, $7.3
million? Yeah, roughly. The bills were like $7.5 million. The request from the administration to do it through like his agencies, like $7.3. But there was a package that he put in the budget, which was actually grew out of a council created under Scott Walker, chaired by then Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. Evers took that package, put his budget as a goodwill gesture, like, yes. Let's get this done. Republicans said, no, we're going to pull it out, put these separate bills, and do it this way. Those bills passed the Assembly overwhelmingly. In June. Now they're hung up in the Senate because of the price tag. Evers said, okay, let's go ahead and go back to my agency requests and do these things through my agencies. Joint Finance released the money. Joint Finance said, no, we're working on stuff. Then he took another rare, if not unprecedented, move of calling for Joint Finance to meet, which basically is a provision in state law that says the committee shall meet for a special call from the governor. They said, no, you know, that's not how you're reading it correctly. We're not gonna meet. Just this past month, they had a standoff like that about something that people agree on, like homelessness. It just undercuts the tension between the two bodies.
7.3 or 7.5 million for homelessness. But you and I saw today's release from the Department of Revenue. GPR tax collections, July 1 through the end of November, are up 7%.
Yeah, now, it's a two-year period. It's early. You know, Bob Lang, every time I call Bob Lang, the director at Fiscal Bureau, and say, Bob, what's this mean? He goes, well, it's too early. We'll tell you in January and the revenue numbers come out. So in January,
yeah,
we'll get new estimates because it could be gangbusters for 4 or 5 months, then tail off in the second half of the year. But yeah, there's a poison atmosphere. And I've said this before. There are two events that I've seen in the last 20 years that really changed the Capitol. One stands by itself. Act 10, there's nothing that will ever compare that, I don't think, ever again. At least I hope not to see it, because it was just, it was brutal to get through that.
Exhausting, draining.
Just but it was after, just after things had gotten back to like maybe detente, how do you say that word, in the Capitol?
Detente,
thank you. We had this, and it basically ripped open all the wounds, and there's just this tension in the building that has not gone away. I don't know if it's going to fade anytime soon.
Okay. It's a good time to ask you. I know this is a year from now, top political issue.
Oh. I hesitate to make any predictions because as we sat here 2 years ago, I looked at 2018, I don't remember thinking, you know what, the number one issue in the election next fall is going to be about pre-existing conditions for those, you know, protections for those pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
That became a huge issue in the 2018 campaign. People weren't talking about that in December of 2017. So I can't predict an issue. Like, will impeachment still be talked about in October? No clue. I can safely say that we should be, one of the key states in terms of the presidency in 2020.
That's it.
So we're going to see the national convention. We're going to see presidential contenders come to visit here. We're going to have a lot of attention, a lot of ads, and a lot of groups who are going to come in and run operations, turn voters out, because there are Democrats who feel like they fell down on the voter turnout operation in 2016. They just done a better job, they would have won, especially a margin less than 23,000 votes. And Republicans feel like there's an untapped potential of rural voters that they can go after and bring out who like President Trump that can offset any gains Democrats have in urban areas and other places.
Okay, I'll go along with, it's dangerous to predict, but it looks to me like, I'll agree with you, the number one political story of the next year will be whether Wisconsin again elects a president. But I think number two might be, how does Foxconn play out? When you offer a company $3 billion, what numbers are they going to put up? Anyway, this is the stuff that's going to make it really interesting 2020. You and I are going to continue with these roles, so I really appreciate it. I'm Steve Walters.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
That's Rewind Year in Review 2019.
Rewind, your year in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.